Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Loopcast. Also, a very happy new year, 2020, big number, and hopefully it will be a great year for everyone. I'm Chelsea Damon, and today we are going to do a show on eco-extremism and accelerationism. So a combination of the two because they have connections. So to discuss this really interesting and very important topic, we have Brian Hughes on the show today. So first of all, Brian, thank you for coming on. You're a fellow friend and researcher at American University, so I'm so happy to have you on the Loopcast.
Thanks so much, Chelsea. I'm really thrilled to be here. I love the show.
Well, we love having you on, and for our listeners, Brian is pursuing a PhD at American University. He also teaches at the university and is a researcher in the Polarization and Extremism Research and Innovation Lab at AU. So he is very well entrenched in the subject and has fantastic research. So why don't we start off by you giving us an idea of the roots of eco-extremism and where it comes from?
Sure. Well, the short answer to that is eco-extremism today comes from our context of ecological crisis. We are, it seems, hurtling ever faster towards some truly troubling reckoning with humankind's impact on the globe and the way that affects the viability of human life on this planet. And the stresses of that crisis and the political establishment's seeming inability to reckon with this crisis, to deal with it and to sort of right the ship of state and put us back on a track for a sustainable future is really what's driving ecological extremism, both on the left, the right, and then in this sort of chaotic, jumbled, neither nor political milieu that's not, you can't quite call it in the middle. It's really both and neither at the same time. So that's what's driving ecological extremism today. But eco-extremism has a history and it has a pedigree. And in some ways, that history and that pedigree can inform our understanding of today's eco-extremism. But in other ways, it kind of confuses it. When I was younger, in the 90s and 2000s, and even back into the 80s, eco-radicalism was really the province of the far left. Groups like Greenpeace, Earth First, the ALF, Animal Liberation Front, the ELF, the Earth Liberation Front. These were all far-left groups that sort of hewed to a kind of, anarcho-communist political ideology. Prior to that, environmental issues really had, in the United States at least, a pretty broad bipartisan base of support. This was until the 1980s when the Republican Party forged much closer alliances with resource-based corporations and business. And then prior to that, of course, you have World War II and the relationship of Nazi Germany to ecology, which had sort of folded into this mystical racialist nationalist project. So there's this history and this back and forth where throughout the 20th and early 21st centuries, by turns, the left and the right really tried to lay claim to eco-radicalism. But what we're seeing now with this crisis that I mentioned at the outset is that these distinctions of left and right, these boundaries are becoming increasingly contested. The people who self-identify as eco-extremists or the people who we might identify as eco-extremists are much more challenging to pigeonhole into either a far left or far right category.
I find this really interesting because, as you just said, a lot of people associate eco-terrorism with one extreme view or another extreme ideology on the political spectrum, do you find that there's any unifying connection of eco-extremism between the left or the right, or the left and the right, should I say, or is it really very fluid at this point?
I would say at this point it's really quite fluid. I mean, I think in a sense what we saw throughout the 20th century was environmentalism as a more abstract concern, and in some ways it was a proxy for other concerns. You know, it was a proxy for this imagined racialism, or it was a proxy for anti-capitalist radical politics in capitalist countries in the West. And today, it's not abstract. It's extremely concrete. You know, Australia is burning to the ground, and Indonesia is drowning. India experiences record droughts and heat waves that are killing, you know, large swaths of its population. So I think that immediacy and that end of abstraction and proxy politics is really what's making it transcend and in some ways complicate and confuse the left-right distinction.
A lot of the time when we hear about environmental changes and global warming and so forth, there's this huge debate about climate change denialism. How does eco-extremism change or even alter this idea of climate change denialism?
Well, climate change denialism wasn't an organic phenomenon. It was a policy and a strategy of disinformation and coercion on the part of resource-based industries and the political groups who made common cause with them. So there's the sense that climate denialism is what put us in this, you know, present-day crisis. And the relationship between the conservative movement and those resource-based industries throughout the 70s, 80s, and 90s, or why eco-radicalism during that period was the province of the far left. But nowadays, there really aren't very many climate denialists left. There's this kind of, you know, inertia that you still see among conservatives and some of the front-facing communications of resource-backed industry, you know, that still pays a little bit of lip service to this denialism. But we know, you know, we know full well that these resource-based industries have been aware of the reality of climate change since the 1970s. And beyond setting the stage for what's happening now, climate denialism is really, it's surprising, actually, how quickly it's just being dropped. The various conservative, right-wing, and far-right political movements really pivoted incredibly quickly from climate denialism to a recognition of a climate crisis. And they really did so without any concern for getting from point A to point B with some kind of ideological justification or pseudoscientific rationale. Really, we're just seeing, you know, one day people are climate denialists or skeptics, and then the next day they're eco-fascists, essentially. You know, it was really striking to watch this on the American far right. You know, my own research tends to focus in the United States and then the Anglosphere. But it really did just happen more or less overnight between, you know, 2013 and 2015. These voices on the extreme right just pivoted, and they didn't really bother to explain themselves.
On that comment, what do you think helped make this pivot happen during that time period you just mentioned?
Well, I think that the availability of media that really puts in the most stark visual terms our present crisis played a large role. When every summer you can watch glaciers just melting down to nothing, when you can watch the Southern California wildfires every year and see these, you know, apocalyptic scenes of people driving down the highway while, you know, to their left and in front of them, a mountain is just completely engulfed in flames, you know, like something out of Dante. You know, you can see what's happening in Australia. The sheer volume of very compelling media that's conveying the reality of our environmental crisis, I think it woke people up even on the far right.
Also, just to make a little input in here, as you mentioned, these horrible fires that are taking place in Australia right now. I know we have a number of Australian listeners, so just we wish you the best. We really hope that you and your family and your properties are okay and everyone's safe, because the fires are completely devastating. As you were just saying, Brian, it is very Dante's Inferno when you see these newsreels of what is taking place.
Absolutely, yeah. Certainly, you know, to my own friends in Australia, yeah, stay safe. It's horrifying.
Yes. You mentioned the far right connection with eco-extremism, and I'd love to pivot the show on how that is manifesting. What are we seeing with eco-extremism being inputted into far right rhetoric and so forth?
Right. Well, when we're looking at the far right and its relationship to eco-extremism, it's important to look at it at two different levels. So on the one, on the level of sort of the political underworld, right, the extremist militia groups, you see increasing rhetoric and preparation for social collapse brought about by ecological crisis. There are some very lurid militia type groups that make this a central pillar of their strategic and ideological positioning. This is also what we read in the manifesto of the Christchurch shooter, who described himself as an eco-fascist, and in the manifesto of the El Paso shooter, who took a great deal of inspiration from Christchurch. You have a substrate of violent extremists, a lot of lone offender terrorists, as well as these very kind of colorful, lurid militia type groups that are motivated by this sense of crisis. And to the extent that they're broadcasting their intent and the propaganda that they're trying to inject into their violent deed, right? We call terrorism the propaganda of the deed, and the propaganda of their deed has information in it that pertains to concern over this ecological crisis. So that's the extremist underbelly of eco-extremism. But we also need to look at the way that far-right governments are beginning to engage with this. Colloquially, it's sometimes referred to as eco-fascism or eco-authoritarianism or fortress nationalism. But there's a suite of ideological positions and increasingly policies that are intended to deal with ecological crisis from a far-right position. So closing up of borders, right, is a big one. As the stresses of these shocks become worse and worse, there are going to be increasing refugee crises, and some of these far-right populist governments we're seeing in the U.S. and Europe and India, for example, are preparing their immigration policies in order to deal with it in such a way that doesn't increase flows of immigration. In some ways, this is a really emerging situation that we need to keep an eye on. There was a very good article published in, I believe, The Atlantic only this past week that deals with this governmental far-right eco-radicalism. And I'd also like to just point listeners in the direction of a blog post on the Verso Books blog called, I believe it was called Eco-Fascisms and Eco-Socialism, which was a very good overview of this situation and some of the concerns that relate to it.
Thank you. That's always good for extra reading for individuals who really want to dive into the subject, especially if they're new to it. So looking at this far-right element of the eco-extremism, and you mentioned a little bit about motivations and ideologies, and I was wondering if we could talk about that, and especially the concept of accelerationism and what that means. So give us, I guess, the teaser of accelerationism, that for those that might not know of it, and how it connects to eco-extremism.
Right. Well, accelerationism means a lot of different things to a lot of different people. But I would say that the most basic, generic way of defining it that covers the most different schools of accelerationist thought is just simply to say that we need to hurry up and get to the end of whatever this untenable situation we're currently living through is, so that we can take stock of what is actually left over after this period of crisis and inaction concludes, and then try to rebuild our world in some way. You know, left accelerationists want to rebuild it according to a sort of leftist ideological project. Far-right accelerationists have their own ideological projects that they're hoping to enact. And then there's a variety of very esoteric, almost science fiction accelerationist positions that have their own views as to our current crisis and what might come after it. It's important. Well, I'll leave that can be the teaser, and I'm sure we'll circle back to it. It's a very complicated topic, and every time you discuss it, you end up leaving a few people mad. So I'll do my best as we keep going here.
That's okay. I have seen the conversations on Twitter, so I completely understand. What could we say are some of the goals attached with eco-extremism and even possibly accelerationism in this sphere with the eco-extremism of groups or movements that hold these ideologies and leanings?
Right. I don't want to name any of the groups specifically, mm-hmm. But the far-right militia-type groups that subscribe to sort of a vision of ecological collapse and what we might call an accelerationist philosophy, what they are hoping for is that through increasing social discord, infrastructural instability, and these massive shocks, right, like hurricanes and fires and then economic crises and things like that, our society, our system of government will collapse. And then out of that chaos, they can emerge and impose their own sense of order and hierarchy, which is violent and racist and primitivist.
Do you ever see in your research groups or leaderless movements, let's say the far right in general, since we're not naming any names, do you ever see them capitalize off of natural disasters? Like we're talking about, we have the huge fires that we've had in California and currently in Australia, hurricanes, etc. Does that become an event for some of these groups or movements to capitalize off of?
Surprisingly, I haven't seen a lot of direct responses to these very visible singular shocks, like the wildfires or a hurricane or something like that. It's interesting, the groups that tend to respond the most to those acute environmental moments tend to be the ones that straddle the line between that political underworld of the militia type groups and then the more overt political eco-fascist movements. So you see groups that are more traditional militia type groups or far right drinking clubs who will patrol against looters after hurricanes, for example. And there's a heavily racialized dimension to what it is they're doing. Effectively, what they're doing is they're trying to police white areas from non-white disaster survivors from coming through there. So those are actually the groups who tend to respond most directly to these environmental shocks. What we see with the more lurid militia groups, the real eco-extremist primitivists, is a more sustained opposition to modernity or post-modernity that really doesn't relent very much, regardless of what's happening in the news.
It's also interesting and also very complicated when you get into the nitty-gritty of it. I feel like there's just so much that is unsaid in the field. You also, you sent us this great piece that you wrote, which I'm sure is yet to be published. However, you discuss capitalism and how this fits in with ideas of accelerationism and eco-extremism. I want to talk about that a little bit and how that factors into this discussion.
Well, capitalism has its own logics, and absent aggressive political intervention into the logics of capital, there's a very relentless expansion and extraction that capital really can't help but undertake. I won't get into all the economics of it, but if left unchecked, capitalism kind of can't help but strip mine the world around it in order to correct the falling rate of profit, which is, you know, more or less unavoidable in any scenario. So what we're seeing is this expansion and extraction that's natural to capitalist arrangements of production that is itself accelerating, right? It's accelerating as the rate of profit decreases. And it's accelerating, too, in response to the increased cyberneticization of the world, right? The internet is no longer just a communications platform. It's really the infrastructure on which we do all of our business. We maintain all of our national security. It's how we run our households. It's how we do our banking. And one of the key conditions of digital platforms, it's what's called recursive feedback loops. And basically what a recursive feedback loop is it's a feedback loop that tends to get more extreme over time. So like the classic example of this is your Netflix queue, right? So let's say that you only watch highbrow art cinema on Netflix. You know, you watch your Criterion Collection and your Scorsese and your Kurosawa, but you don't watch any trash. Well, one day you watch The Wrestler starring Mickey Rourke because it's a fine film. Well, what happens is then Netflix recommends a very good, artful pro wrestling documentary the next time you log on. And let's say you click on that link and you watch that documentary. Well, the next time you log on to Netflix, they recommend some much less artful documentaries about pro wrestling. And it doesn't take too much engagement with those suggestions before you're no longer being offered art cinema, and soon your feed is completely full of pro wrestling and pro wrestling documentaries and historical pro wrestling, right? So if we take that feedback loop that tends to get more extreme over time if you engage with it, and we apply it to things like our economy and our politics and our way of communicating politically, and even the very logics, the very extractive and expansive logics of capital, what we have is actually a system of political economy that is accelerating. It's getting faster, and it's going faster, and it's getting more extreme because it's caught up in these recursive feedback loops because it sits on top of this algorithmic digital infrastructure.
I will just say I loved your analogy in describing that. It was fantastic. So thank you very much for that.
Oh, my pleasure.
I wanted to talk to you a little bit about your personal research that you have been doing. And like I said, I know you sent me a document that is going to be published in the near future, and I can't wait to see it published. So I don't want to spoil anything that maybe shouldn't be spoiled. So I will give you the freedom to discuss some of the current projects you've been working on and your analysis and what you found regarding eco-extremism and this intersection between far-right politics and accelerationism.
Yeah, the journal you're talking about is, I believe it's called Intervention, and the Violence Prevention Network publishes it. Actually, I just got the proofs today. I'm happy to talk about it.
Oh, congratulations.
Thank you. Yeah, it looks good. They do some very nice visual design. Well, what I did was I undertook a study of eco-extremism on Twitter. And there's a microculture on Twitter that sometimes gets called Pine Tree Twitter. And it's known as being eco-extremist, frequently far-right, but also far-left, and frequently a confusing mixture of the two. There's another good article I can recommend for your listeners by Jake Hanrahan, and I believe it was in Wired UK, and you can access it online, and it's about Pine Tree Twitter. It was sort of the inspiration and the genesis for this study. And what I did was I collected a sample population of about 1,000 Pine Tree Twitter accounts, and you know I individually verified based on their content that they were Pine Tree Twitter accounts, and then I coded them according to a series of criteria that marked their ideological commitments. And then their statements of identity. Then I looked at each one of those categories and I assigned it either broadly to the left wing or broadly to the right wing. And what I discovered is that Pine Tree Twitter is very difficult to classify either on the far left or the far right. There was a sizable chunk of pretty unambiguously eco-fascist users. But those only made up about a quarter to a third of all of Pine Tree Twitter. So the vast majority of it was much more difficult to classify along traditional far left, far right spectrum. And one of the things I also found was that whether on the far left or the far right or in this very confused jumbled mixture of the two, Pine Tree Twitter was very closely related to philosophical accelerationism. There were very few accounts that were both in the Pine Tree Twitter microculture and the philosophical accelerationist microculture, but they very frequently followed each other. So one of the things that I tried to understand was why there was an affinity between these microcultures, but why there was so little overlap. And I think that in some ways, a lot of the confusion that plagues discussion of accelerationism really hinges on that distinction, that there's an affinity and there's sometimes a conversation that happens across these microcultures, but to say that there's an overlap is kind of misleading.
So what do you think this project that you've just talked about and have done, what do you think that means for the larger picture of studying this phenomena and also the future of eco-extremism here in the States and worldwide, really?
Well, Pine Tree Twitter is already fading away. Really, once Christchurch happened, it began to break apart. People who do communication studies or even certain kinds of social science research understand that looking at Twitter is a sampling strategy, right? You can only make so many, you can only extrapolate so much from what you learn by looking at Twitter. So as far as like what the future of Pine Tree Twitter is and how it relates to eco-extremism, I don't know if there's a very direct connection or evolution that we can look to, but I think there's an indicator of emerging contradictions and emerging ideological positions that don't track easily onto our traditional our traditional matrix of left, right, authoritarian, liberal, and so forth. The politics of extremism that are emerging, particularly in relation to the environment, if this Pine Tree Twitter study is any indication, are going to be very novel and confusing if we're trying to apply old ways of categorizing it. I'm sorry, what was the second half of your question?
I was just more looking, like, as you just kind of mentioned, the broader picture of what this means for maybe the future of eco-extremism and how that relates to political discourse that we have here in the States and elsewhere. So, yeah, the broader picture, basically.
Right, okay. I think that in the future, what we're probably going to see, or at least the emerging risk that I would hope other researchers and practitioners and people involved in liberal political projects would take into account, is there's a symbiotic relationship between that substrate of eco-extremist violence that we've seen with Christchurch and with El Paso and with some of these militia-type groups. There's a symbiotic relationship between that underbelly and then far-right populist projects. And what we will see, I think, in the future, if the environmental crisis continues to go unaddressed, is both a top-down and a bottom-up pressure on society in response to these threats and these crises. So I think you'll probably see more outbursts of lone offender violence. And at the same time, you'll see more restrictive and authoritarian policies being put into place. And all of this helps to foster a sort of fortress or siege mentality within the general body politic that then becomes more sympathetic to authoritarian responses to environmental crisis. So again, you kind of have a feedback loop where things can really go from bad to worse. Now, I think that the thing to watch out for in the midst of all this is this emergence of hard to categorize political positions. That's the wild card that can make that can throw all of our predictions and our analyses into total disarray and send us back to the drawing board. You know, so many of the arguments over the environment and so many of the ways that extremist ideology formed in the past really had to do with the Westphalian nation state, its fate under globalization and post-modernity, this question of globalism, who is going to reap the benefits of global modernity and who is going to constitute its exploited labor pool. And those questions, in one sense, the stakes are higher than ever as a result of eco-crisis. And on the other hand, they're less salient, or they make less sense than ever. So we're going to see potentially new actors emerging. I guess I would say expect surprises and expect novelty. And this is another place where philosophical accelerationism, which, you know, I should stress, doesn't really relate to these militia type groups, where philosophical accelerationism is correct in its analysis of our present day. There's going to be novelty and there's going to be a lot of strangeness, things we didn't expect, things that are horrifying or shocking, that we're not presently prepared to reckon with, that are going to emerge out of these increasingly chaotic and pressurized and accelerated conditions. So, I mean, it's kind of it's a sandwich with bees in the middle of it, so to speak. You know, you've got on top, you've got the eco-authoritarianism. On the bottom, you have this underbelly of political violence, and in the middle, you have this vast, seething chaos out of which new forms are going to emerge. Anyway, that's what I would predict if pressed.
Well, I think that is a perfect way actually to end the show, because you really encapsulated it all, and it will be really interesting to see what the future holds and research on the subject in the future, since we all love to have everything so nicely packaged and groups boxed with this or that. And of course, as you said, it's pretty much a mixed bag and you're not sure exactly what you're going to get. And it's going to be a fantastic surprise. So it will be interesting to see, as I said, what the future holds for this topic and the greater topics that expand from this.
Yeah. There's no telling, but it'll probably be bad.
Well, we like to try to end things on a positive note, but not everything is always positive. But hopefully 2020 won't be that bad.
Hope springs eternal, and you know, it's up to us. It's up to us to be, you know, it's up to us to stand up for liberal governance and civil society and equity. So, you know, the positivity is inside of us. These are tough times, but I think we're up to the challenge.
Exactly. As my mother says, she has a great quote it's her own quote, but she says, lead by being an example of what you want to see in your world or how you want to see people treat each other. So it kind of stems back to the old wisdom of mom.
That's right. Yes. Your mom's heuristics are usually right.
Yes. Well, I want to thank you so much for coming on the show, Brian, and we will definitely post some of your works with this show. So I highly informed works, and I highly recommend our readers to read them if you're really interested in diving deeper into this subject. So thank you so much for coming on the Loopcast.
Oh, thank you so much, Chelsea. It was great.